We are whistle ready at the Quick Restart Podcast. Like that? Whistle ready.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined once again by Quint Kesnick, and we are talking about week zero, I think. Last week was week negative one. This is week zero. Next week is week one. A lot of teams aren't going to get started until week two. We've got a ton to go over, as there were four games this weekend broadcast on ESPN's Family of Networks, three on the ACC Network, one on ESPNU. Quint, you were involved in three of the four. We are recording in between North Carolina's dominant victory over Denver and Duke's impending hosting of Robert Morris. We hope that that is an exciting game, but not one that renders a lot of what we're going to discuss irrelevant. But first things first, how are you doing? How are you holding up after a busy, busy weekend?
Well, you know, it's interesting to go from like zero games to all of a sudden for three in one weekend. But I got to tell you, the technical folks at ESPN, who a little more than a week ago delivered three giant boxes. They sat there actually when I was at the Senior Bowl, but came home on a Monday, and 45 minutes later, I'm opening the boxes on a Zoom call, assembling a tripod with a camera, a light, monitors, cords, seven different cords. And 2 hours later, I'm up and running. And, The opportunity this weekend to broadcast these games, normally Kark would have taken at least one, if not two. He's skiing, he had a family vacation planned. We really haven't known the schedule, but the opportunity for me to do these games this weekend from my mental health and my sense of why and my mojo, I cannot tell you how fortunate I feel to be put in a position to broadcast these games, and how much good it did me spiritually. I've been doing this a long time, Terry, you know that, and called some big games, a handful, let's say, but that game Friday for me was as emotional a game as I've ever, the build up to get on air. That was like a top five game for me all time.
It's awesome. And it's so well juxtaposed against the similarly lo-fi cathartic nature a week ago. I just want to shout out quickly the two games that occurred on, I believe, January 30th. First was Mercer hosting Bellarmine, a game that was not broadcast at all. And a injured Bellarmine midfielder named Cameron Herbert stepped up and filled the void by periscoping it. It was a really cool look at that level of lacrosse. He took viewers into the post-game locker room, and it was refreshing. It just felt like, all right, we have lacrosse back, but this is going to be a walk before we run type situation. And a couple hours later, Denver hosted Utah. It was a Utes squad that is very, very different from the team they put on the field last year, and yet they put in a game effort against a team that was ranked number five heading into this season, and a team that we're going to talk about in two games in terms of their trip to Tobacco Road this weekend. But week zero, week negative one was really cool, and as you mentioned, unbelievable opportunity to get back and put lacrosse on the big screen on Friday afternoon. We're going to work backwards in terms of talking about these games. Obviously, by virtue of there having been so few games in this weekend, we're going to be able to talk in depth about a lot of them. And then we're going to talk about some of the news on the other end of the spectrum. It was an incredibly rich news week in terms of things coming out. So we're going to discuss those at the end of the podcast, and we're going to take a brief look ahead to some of the top 20 teams that are making their debut next weekend. But Quint, just to begin, as I mentioned, North Carolina, 24-13 victors over Denver. The Pioneers were coming off of a game against Duke on Friday afternoon, and you mentioned at the start of the broadcast that you expected them to come out sharp because they had two games under their belt, because they had figured out maybe some of the face-off woes. And we saw it a little bit. Jack Hanna opened the scoring, gave him a one-goal lead. He had been in a shooting slump prior to that, so it felt like a good step forward for the Pioneers. And then all of a sudden, the buzzsaw switched on for the Carolina offense, and they scored 14 of the game's next 15 goals, at one point leading 14-2. Obviously, at that point, the game was well in hand and decided. This is still in the second quarter before halftime. I mean, in the thing about it was just the variety of ways in which Carolina was scoring. What did you see from the Tar Heels?
Well, Denver couldn't play at the pace that Carolina was setting. And you know, if you watched our broadcast, what was most remarkable to me was the variety of ways they scored, whether it was settled, transition, riding, rebounds, and then the depth of contributions, you know, for guys. Obviously, there's Tanner Cook, Justin Anderson, and William Perry, first midfield, and your first attack. But when a Ryan O'Connell has such a strong game, when a Connor McCarthy transfer from Princeton has such a strong game, when they're able to play a bunch of shorties who look like they've taken a step forward, and Connor Marr, Parker Alexander, Alex Bresci, when you're getting a healthy Evan Egan back on the field to go with Will Bowen, who's taken a massive step forward, maybe the best player in the country.
He looked awesome.
Based on what we saw today. I mean, he was everywhere. The ground balls, almost double digits, being that free runner in their ride up on the midfield line. I mean, he was – my eyes were on 24 a lot. And then their faceoff work was good. Zach Tucci, who had been a little banged up, didn't scrimmage last week against High Point. And Andrew Tyre – Who's you know, he's not the typical body type for a Fogo. He's about 6'2", 180 pounds, and he offers some good things in terms of the ground ball scrap and handling. There's a lot to like. Matt Wright, 20, their long pole was good, and then Jacob Kelly coming off the bench and Alex Trippi coming off the bench. I was extremely impressed. This team just kind of picked up where they left off from a year ago when they were 7-0. They were a great passing team. They were a high-scoring team with some defensive question marks. Well, I think their defense is better this year, and I think their goalie, Colin Krieg, looks like he solidified his role as a starter. So they're better than they were last year. How much? A good amount better, I think, based on what I'm seeing defensively and the depth of scoring.
Krieg finished with 11 saves and 6 goals allowed. Gray had 6 goals and an assist on 12 shots. Nicky Solomon had 3 goals and an assist. You mentioned the ability to score in transition, feed the inside, dodge down the alley. One of the things about this game that I think is going to have to be reconciled in order to properly utilize it as a tool for evaluating these teams going forward, and you made this point on the broadcast a number of times over the course of the weekend, the lack of non-conference play means that each non-conference game that occurs is going to have more value. Because we're going to see a little bit of an echo chamber situation developing when the Big East is playing each team twice, when the Big Ten is only playing their conference opponents, when the MAC is only playing its conference opponents. So the question that will emerge is not only how do you account for the fact that Denver played 2 games in less than 48 hours against 2 of the best teams in the country, and so the fatigue, the emotional wear and tear, etc., had a factor in it, but also, I mean, the word that just keeps coming to mind when it comes to Carolina was incandescent. That play, I believe it was in the third quarter, when number 23, the midfielder,
Parker Alexander,
reached back. He was falling down, caught a one-handed pass, got back to his feet, and just unleashed a laser. Like, that is a turnover 99 times out of 100. You can obviously point to the own goals. You can point to the 50-yard assist pass that I believe O'Connell had to Gray when Denver, I think, went into a 10-man on their man-up ride. There was another half-field goal. It just felt like one of those games where everything was going right for Carolina and everything was going wrong for Denver. How do you try to contextualize that aspect of this?
Well, they play, you know, I use the term a no-huddle offense because everything they do is no-huddle. They're trying to inject tempo into this game. And if you can't deal with that, then all of a sudden things start unraveling. Like you're processing speed on the clear. You know, I catch a pass and all of a sudden a guy's on me and my eyes drop. And next thing you know, it's a double team. Denver wasn't able to deal with the speed at which Carolina was riding, at the speed that Denver had to make decisions. I thought in the second half, Denver's half-court offense started to look like it should. Now, they still lack speed and lack quality dodgers, but you saw some nice drawing of double teams, pass, re-dodge type motion. So it looked like it should in the second half. They didn't finish some of those plays, but you know, I leave after watching Denver, I leave knowing Jackson Morrow and Ethan Walker can play for any team in the country. Jack Hanna's a really good player, and Lucas Kotler has his moments, okay? Who else can this team rely on? Where's their star freshman? Where's their all their offensive talent? Where's their speed on offense? Okay. Danny Logan's an elite shorty. They're in good spots there. Their defense, it seems okay. I think holding Duke to 12 goals will actually stack up at the end of the year as being like, hey, that's pretty good. You held Duke to 12 goals. But I still need to see more playmakers. They're, I don't want to say robotic, but they need to make more plays. Their zone is a little bit of a stand around zone. They're not moving enough. They're not getting the hands and impacting passes. And then lastly, the goalie situation, maybe it ironed itself out because I really liked what I saw from Cole French today. And then Stathakis, for as average as he was against Utah, took a giant step against Duke. I mean, what was he, 19 wins, 20 out of 25 with 12 ground balls? Yep. Today it was menza, you know, against really athletic wingers. You know, he, that's the area of his game I think he's got to clean up, is his escapes and his handling. So I don't worry about Denver in the faceoff department, but the defense, they just got to start making more plays. And then offensively, they've got to figure out a way that they can get more goal scoring chances without having to, you know, run by or blow by somebody, because they don't have explosive speed on offense.
To me, one of the factors in both of these games, the loss to Duke and the loss to Carolina, it's really hard to talk about these games separately because to me, there were some through lines that connected them, even though the outcomes were pretty different. And one of them was Denver's ability to clear, particularly against the 10-man ride. And it wasn't simply about the long sticks' willingness, their lack of fear, their how frequently they got caught in double teams at either side of the midline, but in a situation where there was someone open. That's the idea of the 10-man ride, right? There isn't someone that is apparently open. But
Terry, the goal is open.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
It's a 10 on 10. It's either somebody's open, where is he? Does that change? Or is the goal open? So
here's my point. The 10-man ride means that the ball is being pressured and no one is open. But if you are carrying the ball and you're getting double teamed, that means someone is open. So even if they are in a 10-man, there is someone open. And twice in the first half against Carolina, I saw Ethan Walker come over the midline, be wide open for a very easy 20-yard pass and just get missed. In one instance, the ball carrier ran into a double team and turned the ball over. And in another instance, he threw it to a player who was covered for a difficult catch, and it turned into a clear, but it was not as easy as it should have or could have been. This is an aside. The clearing stat needs to be adjusted for the way that the clearing mechanic now works in light of the shot clock era.
I saw your tweet. It's ridiculous that they'd get credit
for just clearing, just crossing the midline. Denver turned the ball over 15 times against North Carolina. According to the stats, they cleared the ball 14 out of 16 times, which suggests that they only turned the ball over at the defensive end, or clearing, twice. I can promise you they did not turn the ball over 13 times in their settled 6-on-6 offense. They turned the ball over, I don't know, I didn't chart it myself, so I can't tell you.
Because that's really misleading.
Exactly, it's incredibly...
Because my eyes and my stat sheet tells me that there were three broken clears that led directly to goals.
Exactly, that was the other point I was going to get to, which is that it's not just about the failed clears and the fact that it gets them hampered defensively, it's the fact that they are giving up goals in these scenarios. And the last thing I'll say about this, and I think that you brought this up previously, just the idea of Denver as an offense in the shot clock era. One of the things that opposing coaches know about Matt Brown is that a big part of his offense's success relies on misdirection. I had a coach refer to it as kabuki theater when we were talking about it on Saturday.
Oh yeah, they show you, they dance over here and all of a sudden the ball's on the other side of the field and they're attacking emptiness.
And the problem is that when you have Teddy Sullivan and Jack Hanna combining to shoot, I think, 0 of 24 against Duke, you think about a possession shot, and it's not that damaging. But it is damaging if the restart comes with 20 or 25 seconds left in the possession, because it doesn't allow the offense the time necessary to create the misdirection that usually yields good shots. And so I think that that's the part of this that they need to iron out. When are we allowed to take these potentially possession shots. How late in the shot clock are we allowed to do it? And when you compound it with the fact that not only are they clearing inefficiently, when they are clearing successfully, it tends to be pretty slow. You're already pushing, putting pressure on your offense, whereas you might typically have 70 seconds or 65 seconds. It seemed too routine that Denver was starting their offensive possession with their six-player personnel on the field with 50 seconds to go on the shot clock. So if you then take a possession shot with 30 seconds left and, you know, it goes out over the sideline, well, then the restart is happening and Jackson Moore's got the ball on his stick with 22 seconds left in the shot clock. Denver is not designed to get good looks in that scenario.
Now, my issues with – Denver's going to play at a slower pace. I get that. They can win that way. They can get good at it. Two things stand out today. Like, their turnovers on offense were catastrophic, leading to Carolina runouts. Two would be – like, if you're a lacrosse team, any level, I'm not just pointing at Denver. I'm talking high school, college, or pro. You can score off of transition, faceoffs, settled, extra man, rebound, garbage. You can score off the ride. You can score there's certain ways you can score. Like John Danowski always talks about, well, there's six ways you can score in the game. And if I think Denver's kind of limiting themselves to half field. Have we seen a fast break goal in two games? Have we seen a faceoff goal? Have we seen a riding goal? Have we seen a garbage goal?
Like, have we seen an extra man goal? I mean, I'm having people texting me that they should decline penalties.
No, I know. So, again, at the end of the day, when they only get to 9 against Utah, they got to 10 against Duke. Today in the second half, they picked up and got to, 13 or 12 or whatever it was.
Yep.
But again, if you're just reliant on half field, the way they play, the tempo they play, the getting to 12 or 14 goals is going to be a challenge for them. And when they're facing one of these ACC teams this year who can score, it's going to be an issue. Now, in their league, when they're facing Georgetown, I don't think it'll be as much of an issue because Georgetown is similar in the way they're built to Denver.
I've got more to say about Denver, but I want to move on to Virginia Towson. So last thoughts on Carolina, anything you didn't say about the Tar Heels?
No, I mean, you know, the only thing that stands out, like I look at I was really impressed with everybody seems to have taken a step forward. Didn't see much of their freshman class. I don't know if they don't need it, but I was just wondering like who they got as a freshman class, you know, like who's the next wave. Cole Herbert would be the guy. He got some runs today. Didn't get to see their transfer from BU, Lawhead, Colin, number 50, and didn't see the shirt singers. I think Harrison is out, and I think Henry's got some issues. And Will Nicholas, who kind of turned the corner last year, didn't see him as well, or Aritain. So there's more there. That's the scary thing. But I was really impressed. They look like a happy team. They look like there's a great chemistry there. I didn't see a single point in that game where I didn't see maximum hustle. I didn't see a single point in that game where I saw really anything selfish. So I loved what I saw.
Coincidentally, many years ago, 6, 7, 8, 9 years ago, Bill Tierney told me that you never want to scrimmage Carolina because for whatever they can, you know, at the time they were disappointing in their quarterfinals or whatever. This was before 2016. He was like, their twos against your twos are just going to be a slaughter. And it's going to ruin your confidence, and it's going to make you just totally question everything that you're doing. And I think that is the point that you were just addressing. Moving along, the Virginia Cavaliers topped the Towson Tigers 20-11 at Clockner Stadium on Saturday afternoon. The Tigers were playing without Coach John Nadelin, who is serving a 2-game suspension for a self-reported NCAA violation. That was news that broke during Duke's win over Denver on Friday afternoon. But that being said, it was a pretty even game early on. James Avanzado showed some spark offensively. I believe this game was tied 4-4 before the Cavaliers broke the game open. From an offensive standpoint, Connor Schellenberger, the number one recruit in Inside Lacrosse's class of 2019 Power 100, made his career debut with 4 goals and 3 assists. He, like Brennan O'Neill, who we are going to talk about momentarily, scored on his first career shot. Also, Peyton Cormier, who is one of the more interesting players in terms of the circuitous path he has taken to get to this point in recent memory, had 6 goals and an assist, but there's a lot more meat on the bone to discuss in terms of the Cavaliers. Quint, what did you see?
Well, let's start with Towson. and we'll work through them rather quickly after a good start, really good start. Guys who stood out to me, I thought their goalie, Shane Brannan, looked the part, and he's going to be fine this year. Garrett Zangeli on defense, big, tall, number 35. He finished the game with nine ground balls, okay? That guy's a pro someday. He is really, every time I see him, he's gotten better. Remember, he didn't start until his senior year of high school at Calvert Hall. Lefty, he was a late recruit. And he started off as a pole. Now they're playing him a little more down low. But, man, up in that zone, he played a great game.
He's 6'7". He looks like Mike Simon.
I mean, no, this kid's got a bright future. Kobe Smith, I thought, looked much better this year off ball. You know, his issues last year, if you watch the tape, was, you know, when his guy cutter, you know, he had a slide decision to make. Like, he wasn't so buttoned up there. I thought he played a much better game subtly in the 6-on-6 sets. And clearly – he picks his spots really well to run and transition to make plays. You know, he's got a great gauge. When is it time to take a chance? When do I make a run with or without the ball? You know, how does he impose his will on a game? So I thought those two guys you can build around on defense. Offensively, I think that's where we get the question marks. You know, Brody McLean's going to be a nice player on the lefty wing or tight to the goal. You know, Milani and Avanzano, but, you know, who's your Dodgers? And they just – there's a lack of speed Dodgers, guys who can draw double teams against a very athletic Virginia defense. So, you know, are they going to have to use more picks? Are they going to have to invert more? What's it going to look like in the CAA? I don't know. So it wasn't all bad. I thought it was actually better than last year from what I saw from Towson. So I think clearly they will have a better, that's not saying much. They were 0-6, but I'm not as down on Towson, as I thought I might be. If you're just looking at scores.
I agree with that. You know, there are a couple other aspects of the game that I'm interested in seeing them continue to improve at or get better, just particularly at the face-off X. That's a part of the game that I'm interested
to see. That's
going to
be an issue, yeah. Well, they were horrible there last year, 33%, and it just wore them down to where they, you know, they got killed in the fourth quarter of games and just asking too much for their defense. So how does that turn out with whether it's, you know, Shane Santora? I liked his feet. He looked good at times. Joey Chestnut can come off the bench and do some draws, so we'll see there. But Virginia, man, ooh, that was impressive. That was impressive.
I mean, to playing think without that you get Matt Moore.
No there. Matt Moore and Docs Aiken only took a handful of runs. And all the new faces, you know, Charlie Bertrand. Man, what a player. What a player. Division II player of the year. Fit in right away. They ran him at midfield and attack. He scored from a variety of positions on the field. Connor Schellenberger, his speed. I mean, he looked like if he was wearing number 5, I mean, he would almost look like a clone for Matt Moore. And then Cormier is just a beast now, man. How big is he? He, you know, Lars hinted that he might be as much as 240 pounds, but he is a Cloutier clone. Virginia, again, I liked, they seem to, they just seem to be on not a week zero type offense. I mean, everything just flowed so smoothly. Their roles and their comfort level with one another, really amazing. And their ride was nasty.
And Petey LaSala picked up 14 ground balls, added a goal and an assist from the faceoff X as well.
Yeah, and well, at the end of the day, LaSala's ability to change the rules here. You know, he was kind of a pinch and pop guy in the past, 59% last year. Can he handle this? They got Gable Braun behind him. Maybe the two most improved guys in the team, though, Quentin Matsui, close defense, and Scotty Bauer. Okay, they had a half a year last year to kind of figure this thing out. They're both, I guess, considered sophomores now. And the Connors is outstanding. Kaloji's steady as a rock. And their shorties are going to be good this year with John Fox and Soliday. So, like North Carolina, a defense that is better this year. They struggled a year ago defensively with losses to Princeton and Brown. So, everyone will talk about the offense, but, you know, I like what I saw defensively.
Did you see what you needed to see out of Alex Rode?
No, not early. I thought he didn't look like himself early in the game, in the first quarter.
You talked about some challenges in terms of the clearing game and particularly being settled on his passing releases.
Yeah, well, his feet, you know, you got to step with that opposite foot, and sometimes he kind of jump passes or fades away, steps backwards towards the goal. He's just got to be a little more patient with the ball. And this is something I drilled with him years ago when we were out in at the Ride, actually. How long ago does that feel like? Out at the Nike facility. It's something all goalies have to work on. You know, how when there's a guy in your face, how do you not sacrifice your fundamentals, and how do you still make a good pass? But, you know, Alex will be fine. I've always thought that that early game in February or March, cold weather, you know, it takes some goalies times to heat up, and I have full confidence in Alex.
Towson hosts St. Joe's on Saturday, February 13th, and then Duke on Saturday, February 20th. The Cavaliers are currently off until February 20th, but Lars Tiffany said that he's trying to add another game, and there was a potential opponent who was planning to play on the 13th that we will get to later in the podcast now has opened up. The Cavs are scheduled to head to Loyola on the 20th as their next game. All right, Friday afternoon, it was a game that you already discussed in terms of being very emotional, which is just cool to hear. I mean, you know, it's happy hour lacrosse. We're all glad it's back. It was a sunny afternoon in, you know, kind of that lower mid-Atlantic all the way down to Durham component of it. It just felt like spring was on the horizon, and certainly the addition of Michael Sowers in a Blue Devil uniform as well as Brennan O'Neill making his debut after being, as you called it, the most hyped recruit in college lacrosse history for a variety of reasons. And they came out of the gate slow, or I guess it's better said that Denver came out of the gate fast. What did you see from the Pios early, and how did that compare to what you saw from the Blue Devils late?
I just saw a crispness in their offense, good spacing and passing. The faceoff domination gave them the extra possessions early in the game, and their goalie Jack Thompson was good in the first quarter, making four saves. And slowly things kind of got away from them. That 8-4 halftime lead,
they were up 6-1 at one point early in the second quarter.
8-4. Things got away. Give Duke credit. They've got options and so much depth that they're going to wear on people. They're going to lean on people.
We've talked a fair amount about, I personally think that a lot of what we talked about in terms of Denver's issues from a clearing standpoint and from a shot clock management standpoint, and particularly some of that errant shooting from the midfield, the inability to draw slides and create easy goals, was the difference, right? That's why their offense went from being efficient at about a 33% clip through the first 20 minutes or so of the game, and then efficient at about a 10% clip in the last 40 minutes. I think Duke's defense, which coincided with a goalie change, Mike Adler, the St. Joe's transfer, grad transfer who started, was replaced by Turner Upgren, who played really well from that point on. Definitely had something to do with it as well. But ultimately, yeah. I think that the reason people are listening to this podcast is because they want to hear us talk about Duke's offense.
Yeah, well, okay, before we get there, kudos to Turner Upgren for coming off the bench. Tough situation Mike Adler now finds himself in after transferring, and you get yanked in the first half or first quarter of your start. So Coach Danowski will figure that out. I walk away looking at Duke's D as I'm not convinced. Like, they didn't really convince me of much that they've taken a step forward. Tyler Carpenter, I like a lot. JT Giles Harris, I like a lot. Everybody else, in my eyes, the jury's still out.
So you think you weren't impressed by what you saw out of Kenny Brower?
No, I thought Virginia and Carolina's defense from 2020 took bigger steps forward than what I've seen from Duke so far.
Got it. All right.
Okay. Well, now we turn to the offense.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, Brennan O'Neill, you know, like having never seen him play a full game, I'm relying on the internets, and I got to tell you, everything you pull up is these eye-popping highlights, just incredible stuff. You've seen more of his game than I have, and those highlights are incredible. Like, there's nothing like you've ever seen when this guy just trucks people and scores behind the back goals. But to see him play this game full, to see his hustle on ground balls, to see his effort on the ride, to see his passing ability, like things that you're not, no one's going to put on social media. I was blown away with the depth and those other parts of his game.
I think that's exactly right. I think the thing that stood out to me the most was how much he seemed like a normal player in this game, right? And it was, what I'm trying to say is he fit into the offense. His goals were nice left-handed wing shots. He had one bouncer and one rip, and then he had a third goal that I can't recall right now. But those two shots, which were both off of feeds from X, were just good, normal, fundamental plays. The ride that you, or the effort on the ride that you're referring to me, was their man up ride when he sprinted about 30 or 40 yards, ended up shoulder to shoulder with a Denver ball carrier. He hit him, right? And disrupted the pass, and the pass went out of bounds over the far end line. Duke got the ball back. It wasn't a highlight that you would put on Instagram, but it was an excellent play. And that combined with when we posted a clip of him from Midnight Mania on Thursday in anticipation of this game on Friday, a lot of the comments said something to the effect of, I'm excited to see what he does against defenders his own size. To which I say, how many defenders 6'2", 230 pounds is he actually going to match up against over the course of his college career? Like 5'8"?
No.
And so the thing, in addition to the fact that he just looked like he fit in normally, that stood out is, and I think that this is because he wears number 34, he looks like Anthony Kelly playing attack. Unbelievable.
Yeah. No, and John Donowski talked to us about that, both for he and Sowers, okay? Brendan O'Neill has spent more time down on the ground in the first couple of weeks of practice at Duke than he has in his entire life. He's covered by defenders now in practice who are 6'1", 200 pounds, or really strong like JT Giles Harris. So it's a little bit of a new game for him. And every year in his career, the other guys have gotten bigger. I remember seeing him at the World Series of Youth Lacrosse. I mean, he was probably 6 foot, 200 pounds then. So they've closed that gap. But watching him play the other day, that doesn't concern me. Like, I think going into this game, maybe that concerned me. It doesn't concern me because his game has got so many different layers to it that he's not a power player. He's not reliant on running people over and scoring goals. He can do it, and he can capitalize on a matchup, and you better have a body against him. But that's not his game. There's more to it. There's more to his game. And again, that ride play and his body language and what I saw from him instinctually is everything I needed to see. The hustle, his willingness to hustle, was awesome. And that's like the greatest thing, to see a hotshot high school kid come on the field and display those characteristics. It shows that he's well coached, shows that he loves the game. And that to me, like, I'm a fan now. I'm all in.
I'm a big NBA fan, and the reporter Brian Windhorst always makes the point that NBA rookies don't contribute to winning. They can put up big numbers, they can show you the kernels of what will ultimately become a good NBA player, but they don't contribute to your team winning. I don't think Duke wins without Brandon O'Neal on Friday afternoon, and that's something to be said for a team that's being referred to as a super team. Let's talk about Michael Sowers, who finished with a goal and 3 assists. Handful of folks that college lacrosse coaches I talked to in the wake of that game weren't that impressed, and they particularly weren't impressed because they were puzzled by Denver's decision not to pressure him at X, it seemed, particularly to allow him to get his defender hung up so that he was able to stand directly behind the goal with his hands free, no pressure, trying to figure out a place to feed the ball. What was your impression of Sowers, and what was your impression of Denver's defensive approach to him?
Well, Sowers averaged 9.4 points a game playing for Princeton, an offense that was scripted, centered, choreographed, and built around him. Duke's not done that. And there were times at this game I thought he looked extremely uncomfortable. I thought he looked like they're asking him to do things that he's not built to do. He's a 5'9", generous 165 pounder. He wants to dance behind the goal, and he wants to feed. It seems like John Donowski wants him to post up and question mark and get to the 5x5. And that's not his game. And Denver, they looked at tape. You look at a lot of the highlights, and there's two great highlight rips. Michael Sowers, every point from 2020, Michael Sowers, 2019 highlights, two separate, One of them's like 30 minutes long, but I've watched them both twice. And you start to, like, every play is different. That's what makes them great. You know, it's all unscripted, but so much of the work he does is behind the goal and luring defenses into sending that second defender when he's really not a threat. He hasn't turned the corner yet. And so Tierney said he's not going to get 8 assists. So Tierney said, you know what? We're not even going to go back there and chase you like Colgate did. We're not going to even go back there and try to match feet with you and then decide if we're going to double. We're just going to stay in front of the net, clog it up, and play the shot clock game. That worked. I thought Michael looked a little not in sync with the offense. I thought his traction wasn't what it seemed like at Princeton. He didn't have the same – it looked like he was a little slippery. You know, it was a grass field in February. I thought they asked him to do some things, and I was shocked, quite honestly, that Duke continued to run the ball through some midfielders who are kind of when you got this player behind the goal who I would be running my offense through on every possession. But John Danowski's got the 3 titles. I got none. He knows what he's doing. So I think this is still a feeling out process. I think their offense is very much a work in progress compared to Virginia or Carolina. I think Duke is still really a couple weeks at least away from firing on all cylinders. They just didn't look like they ever really kind of felt comfortable in their roles.
Like we mentioned, this being recorded prior to Duke's game against Robert Morris in Durham. Looking forward to seeing the Blue Devils get back in action in the coming weeks. One more game that we are going to briefly discuss. Utah 12, Bellarmine 7, this one being played in Louisville, Kentucky. It's a nice transition into the first news item we're going to talk about. But want to point out that given all of the positive vibes around the Utes coming away from the way in which folks saw their game against Denver, and obviously Bellarmine coming off that win over a Mercer team that was, I believe, 5-1 or 6-1 before the 2020 season shut down. You know, and important to note that this was a 6-6 game before Utah went on a 3-goal run in a minute 37 second stretch from the 11:37 mark of the fourth quarter. Jordan Hyde had 2 of those goals. He finished with 4 on the afternoon. Tyler Bradbury had 3 goals and an assist. This is an incredibly young team. Those are the 2 stars that I think folks are going to pay a lot of attention to. Ramsey McCreary, originally a Notre Dame commit, had a goal and 3 assists. He is a trigger man from the midfield, and Utah is going to be an interesting team to follow, but at the same time, I think Bellarmine is going to show that they are considerably better than they were last year as well. They got their faceoff guy back, so I think that helped to stabilize that position a little bit too. And this is a game that in 2022 will be a conference game, as the Atlantic Sun added men's lacrosse, re-added, I should say, men's lacrosse, and will receive an AQ to the NCAA tournament in the 2022 season. They're going to be a 6-team league. This is a little confusing. It's a little bureaucratic. Quint, you're going to provide the home run swing at the end of this little spiel, because ultimately, for as important as this story is for Utah, Cleveland State, and Robert Morris, 3 independents that are going to be members of the A-Sun, along with Detroit Mercy, which is a part of the Horizon League. That's the league that they're in total with Cleveland State and Robert Morris. Robert Morris made that transition this past summer. But Detroit Mercy has been an affiliate in the MAC. Doesn't really make that much sense given how Northeast New York State oriented the MAC is, and the fact that it's really far to go to Detroit going to be a much better fit in the A-Sun with Bellarmine, who up until this year, the entire athletics department, except for the men's lacrosse team, was in D2, made the jump to D1 and joined the A-Sun as a full member. And then in addition to that, so that makes 5, Air Force, which is currently an affiliate in the SoCon, is going to jump over to the A-Sun to make 6. So that's the 6 teams that they need in order to get their AQ. You might ask, well, what does it mean for the SoCon, which has been the Southern Conference, has been the team for the team, the conference for the teams in the South to compete for an AQ in the past. Well, this is how it gets confusing. Jacksonville, which is a member of the A-Sun, is going to remain in the SoCon. Hampton is going to join as an affiliate. So they join Mercer, VMI, Richmond, and High Point, also 6 teams. The SoCon holds on to its AQ. We now have 2 6-team AQ conferences, the A-Sun and the SoCon. They're going to cooperate on scheduling, but those AQs bring the total number of AQs in the NCAA Division I men's lacrosse back up to 10. The NCAA mandates that the tournament field can be no fewer than 50% at-larges. So as a result, I think we're going to see the return of that double playing game on the Wednesday before the first round of the tournament. You're going to see the two, four teams, excuse me, with the lowest resumes among the AQs play each other on that Wednesday in order to then get into the 16-team bracket that begins on Saturday and Sunday. But, Quint, what is the most important aspect of this story?
Okay. It's very convoluted and hard to follow for fans. And I think because of that, it was not undersold. I just don't think people understand the significance. I think it's massively significant, okay, because this is a league that becomes, I don't know if I should say sports specific, but it becomes the landing spot, okay? It becomes the Ellis Island. Let's say Stanford wants to add a men's lacrosse team. Well, there's no Pac-12. They can go into this league. Oklahoma, they can go into this league from the Big 12. Let's say Boise or team out west in the Mountain West wants to add men's lacrosse. This is a temporary landing spot because their league doesn't sponsor lacrosse. So this is gigantic for the addition of Power Five and Group of Five potential schools that don't have conferences affiliated with lacrosse. It's the welcoming mat. It's their first stage. Again, for immigrants, it was Ellis Island outside of New York. So this is much bigger, I think, than the average fan realizes right now. This offers potential. No longer will those schools have the excuse of, well, our conference doesn't sponsor lacrosse. Now you have one that does, and they're welcoming you.
You're exactly right, but I'm going to take it one step farther. I don't think that we will ever really know how possible it was that Utah and Cleveland State might have dropped their men's lacrosse programs had they remained unaffiliated independents much longer into the future. We've written about this extensively over the last 12 or 13 years. The opportunity to play for an AQ into the NCAA tournament has been transformative to the sport of men's lacrosse. Johns Hopkins, 100 years as an independent, joins the Big Ten. Syracuse, always the obstacle to getting Big East men's lacrosse off the ground because John Desco liked being an independent. They missed the NCAA tournament in 2007. That winter, the prospect of Big East men's lacrosse becomes a reality. Yale, a perennial doormat in the Ivy League. The Ivy League schedules consistently. They always opened with Princeton and Cornell, which meant that for 30 years, they had played the two best teams in the Ivy League for their first and second game. When there was no conference tournament, and as a result, no AQ to the NCAA tournament, that meant if they started 0-2, they basically couldn't compete for an Ivy League championship. The AQ gets instituted, the conference tournament gets instituted, and now all of a sudden, starting 0-2 is not a death sentence. You win your next four games, you're the third seed in the conference tournament, you're playing your best lacrosse late April, early May, you win two games, and now you're in the NCAA tournament. And that is the launching pad from 2011 to 2018 that created a national championship program in New Haven. If you're an independent like Utah or Cleveland State, you cannot offer those things to your student athletes. So the incentive to continue to get better throughout the course of the year is not nearly as readily apparent as it is for the teams that are qualifying for conference tournament selection or qualification.
Yeah.
And then subsequently into the NCAA tournament. It's hugely important.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a development, absolutely incentive to develop. That's you're 100% right. And gives everyone hope. I mean, even, you know, late April, when we look at it, everyone's like, well, the NCAA tournament needs to expand. I'm like, well, work it out off the conference tournaments. There's about 50, you know, 48 schools who are theoretically in out of bracket NCAA tournament games this weekend. For them, they win, they stay alive. If they lose, their season's done. So good points. And a really positive news story. I think that went, I don't want to say undercovered, but I don't know if people really fully grasp the
it's just too confusing.
Of what this could be.
Yeah, it's just too confusing. But when the next team, when Valparaiso adds men's lacrosse, or when Arizona State adds men's lacrosse, we'll be able to point to this as one of the important factors as to why. Moving to the other end of the spectrum when it comes to the positive news cycle. On Monday, we broke the news that Yale will forego its 2021 season as 40 of 48 members of the roster decided to withdraw. There are four seniors, T.D. Erland being one of them, who will advance toward graduation, four underclassmen who will just continue to matriculate and be a part of the team going forward. Disappointing news on a couple of levels. Certainly the absence of a team that advanced to the NCAA championship game in 2019 and won the NCAA championship in 2018 is a pall over this season. Second layer is the way in which it continues to raise questions around the other six Ivy League teams and what their outlook for the 2021 season actually is. And then the third is just kind of the general nature of uncertainty around sports, around college lacrosse in this COVID pandemic world. Just quickly to touch on another news story that's on our outline but falls in a little bit here. UMass has announced that they are shutting down their athletic program for 2 weeks as a result of an increasing risk around COVID protocols. We saw Michigan go through that already once with a 14-day shutdown. They resumed practice this week. Johns Hopkins shut down the entire campus for 2 days as a result of a scare earlier this week. The point is that you're just going to deal with this, but Yale came out of the gate with the most serious haymaker that could have kind of happened as it, you know, as it compares to this season in general terms.
It's going to mirror the college football season. Okay. The interesting thing is in the case of the three shutdowns, this had nothing to do with the men's lacrosse programs, Michigan, Johns Hopkins, and UMass. But because of campus-wide protocols, those athletes, our athletes, can't compete. So it's going to look a lot like football. Again, the start and stops, the week where you can't compete, how are we going to manage the schedules? What's it going to look like at the end? We don't know. If there's no Ivy League, remember football, there was going to be no Big Ten this year. Football, there's no FCS or limited FCS. What's it going to look like without an Ivy team or two or three in the NCAA tournament? What does that mean for the way the tournament's going to be formatted, structured, selected? My gut feeling is that others will have an opportunity. This could be tremendously beneficial for a team to have a really strong year in the SoCon, in the CAA, in the America East. Get yourself to 7-0, 8-0, you'll be in the top 10. Meanwhile, the conference-only schools like a Johns Hopkins or a Rutgers, you're in a really tough league, or the ACC. Your record is not going to be indicative of the type of team you are potentially. You could be 3-6, third or fourth place in that league, sub-500. It's just going to be fascinating. So I think some of those teams that we normally overlook who can make a run, whether it's a Stony Brook, a Delaware, an Albany, a UMass, and become a national story this year, much like Cincinnati did in football, Coastal Carolina did in football. So that I'm intrigued, and that's opportunity. So that's the positive spin. But I just feel for these Ivy athletes and their coaches. I can't imagine not only to miss out on last year, but not even to have a chance this season. This is really tough on them. And we'll support them. We'll continue to support them, and we're not going to forget about them. And we hope everybody's okay and can find new goals when their immediate dreams were squashed.
You mentioned another news story from the past week, the Big Ten announcing the first half of its men's and women's lacrosse schedules, 5 games stretching from February 20th through mid-March. What was your reaction? Any thoughts on the actual games? I mean, it'll be weird to see Hopkins, Maryland in early in the season.
I was going to hope they would allow some out-of-conference. I mean, there's no reason that the Big Ten and ACC couldn't sit down. And the ACC schools are testing, like Danowski tells us, they're testing almost every day. That's similar to Big Ten. You're telling me you can't get a weekend, a Big Ten ACC challenge for a weekend or two and have some cross-conference games? That aside, I actually like the fact that they didn't give a concrete schedule to the second half of the season. I think that's a lesson learned from the college football season when they were stuck with a rigid schedule and unable to announce pairings at the last minute. In my eyes, again, I've said this to you, Terry, have that Sunday night Zoom call. Hey, coach, medical director, what's your status? We're good this week, coach. We have no problems. Good. Okay. I'm going to pair you with another team that's good. Team Foy, Team Kesnick, you both have some COVID issues. You guys will be paired together. So that way you get less healthy teams. The worst thing is like when you're healthy, you're testing negative and your game gets shut down. And that happens to another healthy team, like right down the street. and yet you guys can't play each other. So the Big Ten, I appreciate the fact that they've left the second half of the season flexible to either reschedule some of those games that may get canceled in the first half. My biggest question, though, is going to be tournament selection. Like you mentioned RPI. The Big Ten's RPI is unique to itself. It's their Big Ten RPI. It has no relationship to the rest of the country.
Correct.
So how are we going to use that as a gauge to pick teams? If there was ever a year that we needed the eye test, this will be the year.
Well, it's a good thing that the NCAA Tournament Committee has almost completely turned over since the last time they selected an NCAA Tournament field for men's lacrosse.
Yeah, no, I don't understand how you're going to use an RPI number that isn't universal to all the teams, because it's not.
Couple more small items to hit. One relating to the Big Ten, Bobby Benson, former offensive coordinator at Johns Hopkins, replaces J.L. Reppert as offensive coordinator at Maryland. Reppert became the head coach at Holy Cross after they parted ways with Peter Burke on January 5th. That late shuffling of college coaches is going to be really interesting in terms of the way that it manifests itself.
It's a good hire for Maryland. Bob Benson brings some significant knowledge of Maryland's team and the rest of the Big Ten that'll come in handy. He's a highly respected tactician and leader of young men. And everything I've talked to John Tillman quite a bit during the process, and I think it's the guy they wanted. It's a good solution, and all signs, everything I've been told so far is that he fits in well. He's come in there with open ears and open eyes. You know, Maryland does some things extremely well, and this will give John Tillman the freedom to continue to coach the holistic approach. Like, he doesn't have to go down and coach the offense. So John can be more of the relationships guys, the mojo guy, dealing with the people, and Bobby can script up the great offenses that he's got a history of. You know, when he's had talent, Hopkins was tough to stop, especially in the extra man. He's you're not going to out scheme him, and he's always going to have some tricks up his sleeve. So it's a great fit. It's a great fit for Maryland. Congratulations.
We mentioned earlier that UMass has been shut down for 2 weeks. They were scheduled to play Army next Saturday. UMass number 14 in our preseason rankings. Army number 15. We think it's logical if the Black Knights take on the Cavaliers. So hopefully that is something that comes to fruition.
Yeah, no, again, like, how does this get done? I know in football it was difficult to be a matchmaker past Monday or Tuesday, and some there's squabbling. You know, where do we play? Like, is it as simple as the coach is getting on the phone, the athletic director's getting on the phone? I don't know. But when you suddenly Army, let's say, is available, and we don't know that they are, but Army has a gap, Virginia has a gap. Hey, we'd like to play. Yeah, we would too. Well, what does that entail? Why don't you come to our place? We'll get it on the ACC network. Or no, we can't travel that far. Why don't you come up here? No, we don't want to go up there. Let's meet halfway. Let's meet halfway in Philly or Delaware. Like, I don't know how this matchmaking process would happen. I would love to see it, though, Terry, because, again, that's the flexibility and the agility that we're going to need this year.
It's interesting that you bring up Philly and Delaware. We'll get to that in a second. Three top 20 teams make their debut this week. Loyola taking on Richmond, the Greyhounds number 13, the Spiders number 20, heading into the 2021 season.
Yeah, well, you know, going back to Philly, like, make it a bus trip. No one has got to get on a plane. No one has to stay in a hotel. You wake up at 7 or 8, you have breakfast, you get in a bus, you drive 3 hours. Virginia's doing the same thing coming up north. We meet halfway. We're back in the bus. We're home by midnight. So, again, for COVID protocols, I think that works better. Well, and financially.
The reason I was going to bring that up in context of the Philly versus Virginia comment is because, or Philly Delaware comment is because, the other top 20 team making its debut this weekend is number 19 Villanova, who takes on Delaware in a game of two teams that are like,
and that's a good,
40 minutes away.
That's a great game. That's a great game. That's a big game. We got Big Ten starting on the 27th, which is that Saturday. What do you got for upcoming games on the 13th? Like, what are the standout games, new teams in play? For the first time.
That's what I just told you.
No, that's it?
Yeah. There are three top 20 teams making their debut on the 13th. Yes. Now, granted, six have already made their debut.
Honestly, I'm underwhelmed. I thought it would be more robust. So you're saying the 20th and the 27th are going to be more, here we go, a lot of people are playing.
Correct. So the Big Ten makes its debut on the 20th. So that's Maryland versus Michigan, Rutgers versus Penn State, and Hopkins versus Ohio State. In addition to that, it's an unbelievable day in the Baltimore, D.C. area because, like I said, Virginia heads to Loyola, Duke heads to Towson. So
Ooh.
we've got Ohio State at Hopkins, Michigan at Maryland, Virginia at Loyola, and Duke at Towson. So it's going to be tough to pick where you're deciding to go. Three of those game times not yet announced, by the way. The only game that we have an inkling of when it's supposed to be is Virginia at Loyola at 5 p.m.
Okay. Yeah, no, that okay, I'm a little surprised. I thought it was going to be a fuller itinerary of games on the 13th, but there's plenty of stuff on the 20th and 27th to look forward to.
Yeah, I would say, the game next week that I'm kind of most circled, it would have been UMass Army. That would have been the game that pitted to, the two most equally ranked teams next to each other. Loyola Richmond, Dan Shamati taking on his former boss, Charlie Toomey, would be probably the game of the weekend. And then Air Force Denver, another local game that is going to be really interesting. And then I guess the last one I would say, and it kind of depends on how Robert Morris comports themselves versus Duke today, but Robert Morris High Point is going to be an interesting one too. The first opportunity to see Asher Nolting play in 2021.
So Terry, you mentioned last week the ability to go out and watch a practice. How'd that go? What'd you learn about that? Everything's been Zoom for us, whether it's talking to coaches pre or post game.
It didn't go at all because both teams that I was potentially going to attend their practice started too late in order for me to be able to get home. In order to watch Happy Hour Lacrosse, I decided that watching Brent O'Neill's debut on TV and potentially trying to get to practice this week was a better use of my
Nice, nice.
time. Quint, that'll do it for this edition of the Quick Restart podcast. We apologize, and we probably will continue to apologize that it is not as quick as it might otherwise be. But this was a great conversation. I really enjoyed it. Felt like I learned a lot. I hope the audience does as well. If you did, tell a friend, leave a rating and review. Hit us up on social media. He's at Hugh Kesnick on Twitter. I'm at Terrence Foy. What's your handle on Instagram?
It's Quint E. Kesnick. Quint E. E's for Elroy. My dad's name was Roy. My mom's maiden name was McElroy. So my middle name is Elroy. So it's kind of rare, Terry.
I would have thought it would be for eccentric.
Thank you, fans, for tuning in this weekend and listening to this podcast. I'm glad we're back. Really exciting time for everybody. I will say IL did a great job last week setting the table for all these games. And we hope everybody stays safe and continues to we continue the season. One week at a time deal. We are whistle ready at the Quick Restart Podcast. Like that? Whistle ready.